solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as the trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
I have a 75-25 rule that 75% of your time should go into leveraging your strengths. If I am weak in technology, I can't enter a business which requires technological input. It's better that I don't get into that business. But if I am very good in consumer insighting, and then you go into fast-moving consumer goods, it is something which I like doing it. It's my strength. Normally, because it is my strength, it is my passion. And I enjoy doing it rather than doing something which I don't like doing it, where I may not succeed. So I think most of us tend to say that, okay, I have a lot of weakness, let me go on improving. And don't take as many steps to leverage our strengths. So I'm saying that we have to go on fine-tuning our strengths, which is far more enjoyable journey. If you have some fatal flaws, which you need to improve upon in your own journey, then of course that you have to take it very seriously. But small flaws, which is part of every individual, you know, each person has flaws. I'm not saying don't do anything about it, but have that 75-25% rule.
Welcome to the 83rd conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host Deepak Jayaraman, and this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and other leading professionals to decode insights around leadership, transitions, and careers. In addition to curating this podcast, I work with leaders with a growth mindset as a trusted sounding board, helping them and their organizations transform and play to their unique potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. I wanted to share a recent development. Amy Edmondson, professor at Harvard Business School, was recently voted as the number one management thinker in the world by Thinkers 50, considered by many as the Oscar Awards of management thinking. And we're really proud to have featured her on the podcast recently. We also have Whitney Johnson, who was number 8 on the list, and 6 others who've been on the podcast. We are truly excited about the quality of the content we are creating, and we are keen to march on. So thanks for all your support and your attention along the way. My guest at the podcast this time is Harsh Mariwala, founder of Marico in 1987. Today we all know Marico is an FMCG giant with revenues of over 7,500 crores. Their products Parachute, Nihar Naturals, Sephola, Setwet, Livon and Medicare are market leaders in their respective categories. Harsh has recently authored the book Harsh Realities along with leading management thinker and guru Ram Charan. In this book, he speaks candidly about the various challenges he's encountered in the journey in building Marico. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Harsh Mariwala.
Harsh, excited to be talking to you. Thanks for making the time for the Play to Potential podcast.
My pleasure, actually. I have been looking forward to this because I have been hearing you, your podcast, and I must say that you are doing your job extremely well.
Thank you.
You're really taking the best out of the out of your guests.
Hey, thank you. It's kind of you. In this podcast, we talk about leadership transitions and people's journeys, but I find it helpful to start with people's early years.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I am curious about, Harsh, is how people get formed. You know, we talk about nature and nurture.
Yes.
But talk to us a little bit about how you are shaped by your early years.
You're absolutely right. I think those earlier years really shaped you. In my childhood, I was born in a joint family. And I was born in the family house. I was not born in a hospital in Bombay only. But it was a family house which comprised of my grandparents, my parents and 3 of my uncles and aunts and their children.
Wow.
And it was spread over 3 floors because it was a large family. But we had one common kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So every day We would have, the dining table could not take more than 10, 12 individuals. So first the kids would sit.
Multiple batches.
Twice, two only. First kids at about 7:38 and then the adults would come in at, once we finished that, 8:39. And, you know, everybody dined together. It was great fun because, you know, it was just, the family has such diverse interests that one was exposed to different hobbies, sports, musics. Music was common, actually. Everybody was interested in Indian classical music.
Mm-hmm.
So every day I would go on hearing Indian classical music. And that's how I developed my liking for Indian classical music. And then in terms of sports, everybody had a different interest. One of my uncles used to sail a lot, one of them riding. My father played golf, one of my other uncles played golf. So I tried everything. I tried riding, I tried sailing, and of course I tried golf. And ultimately I zeroed in on golf as my passion.
Okay.
But what I'm trying to say is, you know, diverse interests, and we had went on doing new things. A lot of business getting discussed in the evenings because everybody was in business. So I was exposed, just sheer learning and hearing from the others was a big thing. And I think that must have shaped my liking for business. And I was very clear from day one that I was not going to work for anybody else.
Awesome.
I had to be my own boss. I didn't have any clue what I was going to do, but I have to be in business. And the other thing is, you know, when you are staying in a joint family, you learn values of tolerance, of consensus.
Hmm.
Of leading a relatively frugal lifestyle. When, and we all had cars, but why waste money in having 2, 3 because you may be going to office. So when you had to go to office, all my uncles, two of my uncles as well as me would go at the same time and come back together. So if it means that somebody was late in the morning or somebody got delayed in the office, one had to wait.
Hmm.
But that's how it functioned. And, you know, I couldn't have rebelled and said, no, I want to go on my own and things like that. Though we could have afforded that. So those early years have taught me a lot in terms of diverse interests, value of building relationships, consensus, tolerance. I think that shaped my future as I entered the business.
And fast forwarding, Harsh, you set up Marico as a separate entity within the Mariwala business construct in January 1990, when
yes.
I read the book. But very early on, in the first two to four years, I think you moved towards a separation. And, you know, I do some work with some of the members of YPO and have some visibility to the dynamics of a family business.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always this tension between belonging and breaking out.
True.
How did you think about that, and what were the pulls and pressures?
See, when Marico was formed in the year 1990, it took me 2 to 3 years to convince the family to separate management from ownership. So what it meant was that I would be the manager in Marico, and I'll be the only family person handling Marico. And similarly, my cousins would handle each part of the business or in a separate company. I think that gave us a lot of autonomy, and that really freed me up in terms of doing things which I always wanted to do. I never thought that within a few years it will lead to a business separation in terms of financially. It so happened that there were some issues which led to a lack of trust amongst the family, and I think that forced us to separate. So it was not something which was planned. It happened because of certain circumstances, which was, I never thought it would happen. But when that happened, I thought it better to separate, because if there is no trust, then you can't exist as partners. So that event, those set of events which happened after Marico was formed, immediately after it was formed, in the first 2-3 years, led to this situation where we also separated financially.
Mm. And in the book, you know, there's a, you know, mention by Uday Kotak, who says that I must give credit to Harsh for his maturity. the Mariwala separation went better than a lot of family business experiences I have witnessed. Back to your earlier point about tolerance and consensus and everything else you said, Harsh.
Yes.
Give us a sense of give whatever is shareable. How do you, you know, if you rewind and think about those days, what did it take for you to ensure you got to a meaningful place?
So, as you rightly put it, you know, I didn't want to pick up a fight. And we've seen many families, their businesses getting destroyed because they go on fighting. So, I was very clear that we needed to have a consensus.
Hmm.
Of course, while arriving at a consensus, there could be some bad blood. I'm not saying, but we would continue to negotiate and arrive at a solution, which is a win-win solution. So I was very, and if it meant that it would take a little longer time, let it be. So the process was to appoint a mediator who was trusted. The key thing, trusted by each and every family member. Because many a times if I appoint a mediator, it is perceived as my mediator, the others will not trust and that whole negotiation will fall apart. But if we have a mediator who is trusted by each and every family member, being neutral, being fair, then that is a big, big asset in any negotiation. And we appointed Mr. Bipin Shah, who was earlier in Lipton's as a director and also on Hindustan Lever as a director, Lipton chairman. He helped us.
And he was your pick and the others built trust? I mean, it always starts.
No, it was, he was known to the whole family from much before.
Understood.
He was known to my father, my uncles, so he was in that age group.
Understand.
But the negotiations were done by me and my cousins, and none of the elders were involved in negotiations.
Hmm.
But he was there as trusted because he was in that age group which of my father and my uncles, you know. And he played an important role in driving consensus. It had to be a little bit of a give and take in terms of what we want to do. So I think that played a very, very important role. And we had to do it in a structured manner, you know, go one by one rather than just, I mean, if they're afraid temper, then he would again play an important role. So nobody should be allowed to go back. Because many a times, you know, what happens is you discuss something, you finalize something in a family meeting today, and after this 1 month, they will say, no, this is not agreeable.
Mm-hmm.
So he played that role, you know, he was there in the meeting, he was fully aware of what was happening, and if something went off track, he would intervene, but otherwise, negotiation would be handled by us, he would guide us, but he would not take sides.
If you had to be immodest about yourself, Harsh. See, one is, of course, the mediator. I'm sure a lot of families appoint mediators. But what was hard for you, you know, as you reflect on those days? What were some of the impulses that you had to resist? Just walk us through what some people often get wrong that you had to.
So, it's painful. Any family financial separation is painful. It's because, you know, there is some degree of bad blood at that particular point of time. So you have a relationship which is very good at a social level, but you know that phase because its financials are involved, there tends to be some degree of bad blood.
Hmm.
And then there is your degree of uncertainty. What will happen? Will it conclude properly? Will it not conclude? So impact of that on business is another thing. So that could lead to high degree of stress. Number three is you are managing a business as well as you are doing these negotiations, which are time-consuming. So, there is that degree of stress. So, I would say a combination of uncertainty, stress, and temporary bad relationships is something you need to go through, and there is no other alternative. I think one has to go through, but looking back, I mean, those 2-3 years were painful, were stressful, were taxing, but I think it has paved the way of the relationships are almost back to normal in terms of socially and things like that. And it's just, it came into a win-win kind of situation where...
And if I may pick up on the, what does it take to bring the relationships back on track? Very often, in that phase, often there's a little bit of a...
Yes, I think somebody has to take an initiative. in terms of within the family. And normally initiatives start around some events, either sad events or happy events, like a marriage or somebody, you lost somebody in the family, and that is the time when the family tends to unite. Mm. Because these are very important events, either very sad events like a demise or a happy event like a marriage. And that is the time when, you know, you start thinking, okay, now we have to start feeling united. And it, over a period of time, I think it goes on, at least in our case, it improved. In some cases, some families, but I think it takes two to clap. So both parties have to forget the past, let it be bygones, rather than holding on to some event which was a cause of stress at certain point of time. And look at future, and you may not be the best of friends, but the relationship is almost back on track.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Harsh speaks about family occasions being an opportunity in reviving relationships. What he says here reminds me of the insight from Professor Katie Milkman of Wharton. She's recently written the book How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. And she was also voted as one of the Thinkers 50 listers. She speaks about how we all can look for fresh starts in our lives. Just like we think about New Year's resolution and use that as an opportunity to change behavior, she says that if we look around, we might find several fresh starts around us.
What we found is that there are moments, this won't surprise you at all, that feel more like fresh starts to people. And the one that we're all familiar with already is New Year's, right? This is a moment when around the world, people are setting resolutions at a higher rate than usual, trying to pursue goals at a higher rate than usual, and it feels like a fresh start. The psychology of New Year's turns out to be familiar and extend to many other moments. But the psychology of New Year's is you can say sort of, well, that was the old me last year. The old me couldn't achieve this, you know, right? The old me tried to quit smoking and failed, but that was a whole different person. The new me in the new year can do it. And you feel this dissociation from your past failures and this renewed optimism as you open a new chapter in life. What we found is that New Year's is actually just one moment that has that new chapter, fresh start feeling. There are lots of other moments on the calendar and in life when we also feel we're turning a page and can get that same dissociation from past failures and motivation and also the likelihood that we might actually step back and think big picture about our lives is greater. So some of those moments include, according to our research, the start of a new week or a new month, the celebration of holidays that feel like fresh starts in our culture, the celebration of birthdays.
If this topic is of interest, do tune into my conversation with Professor Katie Milkman of Wharton. At the podcast, we take a lot of pain and effort to ensure that we bring the best of thinking from around the world to you. As I mentioned recently, Katie Milkman was voted as one of the top thinkers in the world by Thinkers 50, and this award is considered to be the Oscar Award for Management Thinking. We're also proud to state that we have 6 other people who are a part of this list, including Amy Edmondson, who was voted as number 1 in the Thinkers 50 recently. We actually have a nugget from Amy Edmondson later in the conversation. But now let's get back to the conversation with Harsh Mariwala.
I think moving on, Harsh, you speak about your belief in Professor Ramcharan's maxim of remove escape buttons.
Yes.
And you say that in the context of your investments in Midas, your distribution application software.
Yes.
But I was curious about what that term meant.
So, the term removing escape buttons is actually giving prioritization to very high organizational impact initiatives and ensure that the person who is handling that particular initiative doesn't have anything, their life depends on the success of that initiative. And I can give you multiple examples where we have removed escape buttons and that has paved the way for that initiative to succeed. For example, in the earlier stages when we wanted to expand internationally, we would ask the local domestic marketing and sales team to look at some of the international markets. And invariably that would just not get the right attention because the Indian market was large.
Correct.
So it would, their future was not dependent on those creating those two new markets, you know. And so there were enough escape buttons saying that, okay, I have the local market to do. It would always get the... some sort of stepmotherly attention. So we said that if we have to grow international, let's appoint a senior person, a very capable person, only to look at expanding in international markets. And that really paved the way for us to start an international business, which today forms almost 23% of our turnover, which contributes to more than 2,000 crores in top line. But because that person's life depended on creating international markets, that person took initiatives, organic growth as well as inorganic growth in terms of identifying opportunities for acquisition.
Got it.
He had all the time. So we went to different markets like Egypt, South Africa, Vietnam, were able to identify some acquisition opportunity, went into Bangladesh, created the whole market. And all that would not have happened if it was managed by somebody else who was handling that business. And the same thing would be relevant for an ERP package launch. You know, normally when you launch ERP in an organization, it's a big initiative for the organization.
Hmm.
And the tendency is to give it to your functional teams to handle ERP. What we did was that we chose very highly capable individuals cross-functionally, put them at a different location, and their life depended on ERP success.
Okay.
So, 9-month project, nothing but ERP at a different location. And we implemented ERP in such a smooth manner. We got some awards from SAP also.
Interesting.
But the key thing is to remove escape buttons. And also, these organizational initiatives had to be backed by very good quality talent, you know.
Understand.
And the same thing I'm talking about Midas, or even I can give you multiple examples of removing escape buttons for key organizational initiatives which have done well because we removed escape buttons and manned those teams with very high quality talent.
Got it. Moving forward, Harsh, you speak about, this is 1997, right? You speak about setting up three different verticals, right? Nature care, healthcare, and international business. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you had Shrikant Gupte, Pranab Datta, and Arvind Kumar as heads of these three units.
Mm.
And you had to transition to becoming a counsel and a coach to the CEOs.
Mm.
You know, you had to zoom out of the business.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that transition. You know, a lot of leaders I work with,
yes,
you know, who are sort of hands-on when they become a CEO of CEOs, they often, or heads of business leaders, they struggle to make that transition. What came easy and what was hard for you?
You're absolutely right. I interact a lot with entrepreneurs. In fact, I'm helping a lot of entrepreneurs scale up and things like that through a separate initiative, which is known as Ascent. But the key thing I find when I deal with entrepreneurs or when I interact with them is that there is a huge reluctance for them to delegate, to empower others, and to bring a change in the way they were doing things. See, when you are a very small entrepreneur doing things on your own, you're building the business, you're actively involved in each and every part of business. But when you start growing, then you can't handle everything on your own. You start recruiting talent, and then from doing things to getting things done. It's a big shift. So issues of team building, you know, empowering, selecting the right talent, how do you control, monitor your teams, takes importance. But many entrepreneurs, they just cannot delegate. And the key reason I would say is, one is they are too much in love with what they are doing, and they want to be a part of what they used to do earlier rather than saying that I need to do it differently for my future growth.
Mm.
And number two, they don't recruit very good talent.
Mm.
And then they delegate, and because the quality of talent is not good, that delegation doesn't result in good results. And then they start blaming that, see, I delegated and I suffered. But the starting point is to recruit good talent, to create a good employee value proposition, to have a good culture so that talent stays, and then delegate, you know. And I'm not saying, but delegation is not abdication. You have to delegate, and you're accountable for the person to whom you delegate. So in my case, at that time, I've always believed in high degree of empowerment and selecting very good quality talent. So, relatively, it has been easy for me, and I think that would be a little bit more applicable when I stepped down as managing director.
Mm.
Because that was a big shift. At that time, this was a shift to some extent, but the shift from being a managing director to a chairman is a very big shift, because I was full-time in Marico in terms of my time involvement, and now it's just 20-25% of my time. So, it was a big, big shift for me when I handed over the reins to Saugata.
One of the things that companies often struggle with is breaking out of this trap of mediocre talent.
Yes.
In a sense, employer value proposition gets built over time.
Yes.
So the initial crop of high quality talent often people struggle to access because so far you don't have the reputation in the market.
True.
How did you break out of that cycle?
So the formation of Marico, which happened in 1990, gave me a great opportunity to get a new talent, because earlier it was a part of another company, which was Bombay Oil Industries. Mm. And that just freed me up in terms of attracting very good talent. So the first person I recruited was head of HR. And I wanted to have very good talent. So he was XLRI graduate and Asian Paints and some other good companies. And with him, we started selling our employee value proposition of Marico to other external good quality talent. And the fact that he was batting for me, because no amount of me saying that we are not a family managed company would make sense. You know, if with him coming on board as well as his networks, we were able to recruit very good talent, something like 30, 40 senior managers within a period of 6 months or so. And since then, whenever there has been a vacancy, it is always improving our overall standards of hire. Normally tend to fill vacancies with somebody who was better than the earlier incumbent.
Mm.
So that has always been the philosophy. And unfortunately, many entrepreneurs view talent from a cost angle. Of course, cost is important. I'm not saying no. But if you have really good quality talent, then it's worth paying that extra. And it just, when you pay that extra initially to somebody which is above what you are paying, there is some degree of resistance from the existing people. But the moment that person starts performing, then everybody shuts up, you know, because they start seeing the impact of that good quality talent at the higher cost.
It's a good point you make, because
one other thing I just wanted
to
finish this was to say that, yes, sometimes you make a mistake. You may hire somebody at a higher cost. That person is not performing. In that case, you have to send a strong signal within the organization. Okay, I made a mistake by hiring this person. And if you try and improve on that person's performance, you admit that you made a mistake in hiring. It's better to disengage in a fair manner, because you have taken a risk vis-a-vis your existing talent in recruiting somebody at a much, much higher cost. And if that person is not adding value, then you admit that mistake and move on, in a fair manner, a disengagement process.
I think that's something that struck me as well. In the book, you speak candidly about a couple of your colleagues, right? Pranab and Srikant, who say that they felt responsible for the flat performance. And you go on to say that the separation was peacefully handled. So I was curious. The one thing that struck me once again was keeping the relationship intact.
Yes.
Despite the decision. So talk to us about how you
walked out. It is a very tough thing to do. And I've handled such transitions in terms of people who were very, very valued at certain stage in your own journey. They added a lot of value. We have built a very good equation with them, not only in business, but on social side also. And then when it comes to taking a hard call like that, it is very painful. And it is one is very reluctant to do it.
Mm.
But ultimately, you have to see what is good for business. And I've always followed that thumb rule. What is good for business comes first. What is good for any stakeholder, whether it's employees or promoters, comes next.
Mm.
So my stepping down was not good for me at a personal level. I was not ready to step down. But it was good for the company. And so I stepped down, you know. So similarly, some talent which was, because a weak talent actually demotivates others, you know. And what happens in a team, if one or two members are weak, then the stronger team members feel demotivated, and normally they tend to move on, and the weaker talent continues to stay on, you know. So there is a huge negative impact because of that. So it's proactively one has to identify and go on improving one's standards, and if need be, take a hard call, but do it in a humane manner, so that, you know, you give time, you give some opportunity, financially support, so that And it's a matter of time. Those individuals will leave you. They will find some other opportunity, which was based on their on their strengths. And I think over a period of time, it works out well.
I think the other thing that struck me in the book, Harsh, was you know, your evolution over time. I think Hema Ravichander, one of the board members, speaks about how you've leveraged feedback at various points in time in your growth. Give us a the other thing I observe very often is entrepreneurs often don't get good quality feedback. You know, they have a lot of people around them, but very few people show the mirror. How have you approached that?
So you're absolutely right. I've seen many entrepreneurs. It all depends on, and my, I think my journey is based on my own, shall I say, lack of education. I'm just a commerce graduate. So there's nobody who has been a guide to me or a mentor to me. And I've always learned my whole, whatever introduction to business. Of course, I had that genetic mindset in terms of understanding of business, but I never knew all the competencies in terms of functional competencies, whether it's finance or HR or marketing. And my initial years, I have learned, and still I'll go on learning a lot from my own talent. So if I don't know about something, I should have the humility to tell them that I don't know. Please teach me. So I've always had that mindset of learning from people down the line, which has benefited me a lot. So I, over a period of time, developed a very strong belief that I have to learn from others. Number two, I also realized that every person has a blind spot. I may think about something, but I have not thought of a certain angle to that particular decision. So whenever we have sat down in a cross-functional meeting or in a meeting which involves other people, very important issues, some new thought has occurred, come from somebody else, which never occurred to me. So I developed a very strong belief in consensus, especially for some strong, for important organizational issues. So combining the need to learn because of my past backgrounds and the need for consensus has developed a very high degree of openness in me to listen to others. So if you give me feedback, and I may disagree with that feedback, but if I discard that feedback and tell you that, you know, this feedback is absolutely useless, you are criticizing me, then you stop giving me feedback. But if you tell me, give me that feedback, and I said, thank you very much, I value your feedback, but for whatever reason, I don't agree, but please continue giving me feedback. You will continue doing so. So giving that criticism versus critique is important. You know, you're not criticizing me. You're telling me, instead of doing this, why don't you look at doing it like this? And I'm also accepting it. So the way you give feedback and the way it is accepted is very, very important in ensuring high degree of openness within the organization. And we have been sending all our leaders to a 6-day training program on leadership style, on openness, on critique. And I think that has played a very important role in Marico being a learning organization.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I've noticed that people in positions of power, CEOs, entrepreneurs, promoters, and so on, very often don't get good quality feedback. When you ask them, they say that they have an open door policy. But my point to them is, how many people walk through the door to have a candid conversation? I had the opportunity to speak to Amy Edmondson of Harvard Business School, recently voted as the number one thinker in Thinkers 50 Awards, considered to be the Oscar Awards for Management Education. She speaks about the calculus of silence and uses the example of Bridgewater Associates to speak about how Ray Dalio makes it possible for people to speak with radical candor. The term calculus of silence is her way of talking about the trade-off that people have in mind between speaking up versus staying silent in an organization.
The calculus that I describe is something that's very simple, which is that if you're at work, there's an old saying, better to be, you know, better to risk being thought a fool than to open your mouth and, you know, prove it beyond a reasonable doubt or something like that. It's a bad saying, but it's wrong, right? It's wrong in today's world, but the But the calculus is such that if you think about it this way, if I think your plan might be fatally flawed and I'm your subordinate, you're my boss, in that moment, I might be wrong, right? So in that moment, I can speak up and maybe save the day, but maybe not. Maybe you won't be mad at me, but maybe you will. And whether or not all of that will happen is going to be delayed, for sure. I mean, your anger might not be delayed, but whether or not my intuition about the plan was right or wrong is going to be hard to sort of figure out objectively for a while. Whereas if I'm taking a risk, in other words. Whereas if I stay silent, there's no risk in that. If I stay silent, I'm just there. Nobody knows. You don't know. Nobody else knows that I had a thought in my mind. I had an objection and I didn't share it. So I talk about that as this fundamental asymmetry between voice and silence. The voice calculus will always lead subordinates towards silence, not voice. Therefore, as leaders, you have to override that natural instinct. Now, the Ray Dalio case, Bridgewater, is a very special case. I call it an extreme case, where he understands, he so deeply understands that voice calculus, that asymmetry, where silence is generally cost-free and voice is expensive for people, that he says, why don't we flip that on its head? He says, why don't I reframe silence as unethical? And think about it. It's a really strong statement. And yet, there's a way in which we have to agree with that statement. Right? Because if you had a concern about an important decision or issue in a work environment, you know, a strategic decision or a patient care decision, it doesn't matter, and you decided to hold it to yourself because it's safer that way, that is unethical, isn't it? Right? Because you have training, you have expertise, and we hired you to share some of that training, that expertise with others. And so I think it's rather interesting, and that's why I highlighted in the book that Ray Dalio labels it as such, where he just comes right out. Instead of saying, hey, we'd love to hear from you, he says, hey, when we don't hear from you, you are really not doing your job. In fact, you're so much not doing your job that I believe it to be unethical, right? So it's pretty extreme, but it's provocative, and I love that.
I hope you're finding the podcast of value. Do take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you consume the content. Let's now get back to the conversation with Harsh Mariwala.
I think it's interesting, staying with this theme, Rajiv Bakshi in the book mentions that the greatest accomplishment and the strongest suit of Harsh is possibly leveraging the board members individually and collectively to stimulate discussions. It's not just about having six experts around the room,
yes,
but how do you get the collective might? So talk to us a little bit about that.
So in terms of board constitution, I'm very clear that each person brings a certain set of competencies at the board level. If I look at my board, we have one digital expert, we have an HR expert, we have one finance expert, we have one retail expert, and we have one FMCG expert. And individually, I may need to get their viewpoint in the board meeting or outside the board meeting. Not only me, but the managing director or the CXO, they can interact with board member directly, depending on the kind of issue they're facing. For example, the HR head would interact with the HR person on the board. But collectively also, it's very important that we have the right chemistry in the board and the right set of issues to be discussed in terms of agenda creation. And most importantly, the role of chairman, you need to give a very high degree of assurance to the board members that on statutory issues, on governance issues, we are at a very high degree of compliance and they need not worry about it. And most of the issues are strategic issues, talent judgment issues. And that's where you can take maximum out of a board. So if there is a strategy issues which in the board meeting there is a functional expert. Normally, as a chairman, I would ensure that I'll go ask each person what do they think about it, and I'll go to the functional expert the last. I don't want domination in the board meeting to be by that functional expert, because if that functional expert says something first, others will just stop talking about it. So you have to follow a process wherein you get the maximum out of each member. And of course, the functional expert will come in, but that person should come in last. Because if that person comes in first, then others will not just open up, because that guy's knowledge on that particular subject is much, much better.
It's very interesting you say this. On this podcast, I had the opportunity to speak to Vishwanathan Anand,
yes,
and the chess legend.
Yes.
And one of the questions I asked him was, when you put together a team to prepare for a tournament, by definition, you're world number one when he was world number one.
Yes.
Everyone else is sort of second. How do you really, you know, get their contribution? And he said something very similar.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you speak last.
Yeah.
You know, because if you speak, then the others don't say anything beyond that.
True.
So it's interesting you mentioned that.
That is the role of the chairman. The chairman has to have very good chemistry. So at one level, you have to take steps to improve chemistry, including selecting the right board members and going for retreats, having some non-business events, bonding events and things like that, just to build that chemistry.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. The point by Harsh around going to functional expert last is a simple but a profound one. As I mentioned in my conversation with Harsh, here is a clip from Vishy Anand where he speaks about leveraging the power of the team.
Yes, over time I've learned that the first rule, I think, is actually well known, that you don't get in your own opinion first. Don't offer one. Because once you offer an opinion, you often spend a lot of energy defending your opinion rather than even when you think it's wrong, you don't want to lose face. And so that, when my team would show me stuff, my first skill was to keep my mouth shut. Because if what they said turned out to be better, then it's better not to have opposed it in the beginning. I find that in the sense I'm more open to contradictory opinions of people who disagree with me violently, because I realize, well, that's kind of the path to understanding. Over long periods of time, you learn how moody people are. You see the real side. And you need a certain kind of tolerance with that. You need a sense of how good or bad or pleasant or annoying you can be. What people may like in you in day one may not be what they like in you in day seven, and you have to be aware of that. I think you perceive these things much better. So over a long camp nowadays, I'm able to tell if I'm grating on my trainer or he's grating on me. And it's not perfect still, but you know, you get better at those things. And in the end, if you create the most congenial atmosphere, you'll produce the best idea.
I guess leaders need to work extra hard to produce the right atmosphere to ensure that the best ideas in a group bubble up and are given due attention. Let's now get back to the conversation with Harsh Mariwala.
Let's talk about getting the right talent, right? I think even early years, apart from one is sort of looking for skills, competencies for the job.
Yeah.
But what are some of the, let's say, the soft elements which are must-haves for you at different levels?
Yes. So at all levels, there is one must-have is that burning desire to succeed. You have to be self-motivated. I'm not the kind of person who will nurture others and, you know, okay. But that's not me. Okay, I want self-starters. I myself am a self-starter. So don't expect too much of nurturing from me in your journey. You have to answer your own questions. And if you have that burning desire to succeed, you'll develop that grit, which is a combination of passion combined with determination and perseverance. You want grit. You don't want just passion. Because every person will have setbacks. If you have that grit, you will try harder and overcome that setbacks. So you need a person with a burning desire to succeed and a very high degree of grit. That cuts across any person within the organization. Having said that, I think at senior levels, I probe a lot on leadership styles. What is the leadership style that person is bringing in? How can that person influence others? rather than a control person. I want a person who can influence others, you know. And to what extent that person is getting that outside in. At senior level, you need more and more outside in. What is happening around the world in each and every area, whether it's digital or whether it's HR or new product opportunities or what's happening in geopolitically, you have to be aware of what's happening and how it is impacting the organization. What can you do proactively to overcome that potential threat or make an opportunity out of it? For example, in our whole e-commerce journey, you know, it could be a threat of going to e-commerce sites like Amazon, or it could be an opportunity if you manage it well.
Right.
So can you proactively look at discontinuities in the environment and encash on that in terms of new product launches or any of the trends which are happening in the area of technology so that you're not vulnerable in terms of it hitting you. But the likes of Nokia or Polaroid have happened because the top management has just been, there was so much of inside out and not outside in.
Mm. And on board members, any pieces around, the distinction between being an effective executive and an effective board member?
Yes.
Is there a nuance you look for?
I think it's very important that the board retains independent. So the board has to critique and don't have to get into the strategy side of the organization. The strategy has to be developed by the internal team. Because the moment board gets into strategy, then you're taking monkey on your own back and you lose independence as a board member. So it's very important to have that fine distance between independence and getting involved.
Mm.
And I think that's very important role of every board member.
Mm. I was looking for an attribute, you know, apart from the stuff you spoke about, resilience, perseverance.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you look for at a board level, in a board candidate?
So again, how is board in terms of giving feedback, you know?
Mm.
How mature are they in terms of, because, you know, if you start looking down upon management, it will not cut ice with the management, saying this board member thinks no end of things. Of course, you can challenge. You have to challenge internal team members. The board is, another thing, board has to be very good judge of talent. So, because ultimately, one of the most important roles of board is to have the right CEO on board and to make that CEO perform better. Not only CEO, but CEO and CXOs. So, the board has to get involved in selection of CEO, CXO, if need be, mentor them, assess them, what kind of development they should be going through in terms of job rotation or any other experiences, training programs, coaching. That's a very, very important role of the board. And to that extent, each board member should be very good in judging talent and helping talent perform better.
Let's talk about the other transition that you were beginning to talk about, Harsh, the transition to Saugata.
Yeah.
Once again, in the book, what struck me was the openness in the relationship. I think at some point, I think it says that he was getting, not concerned, but he was beginning to think about his journey, his future, his ambition.
Yes.
And he reached out and had a very candid conversation about here or elsewhere. Mm. Talk to us a little. Once again, what struck me was the openness in the relationship.
Yes. So it has been very open, and I think that's been my bedrock of my own organizational, shall I say, on my leadership style, open and transparent.
Mm.
And if you read the book, I've given areas where I have goofed up or I've made failures, or even in some cases people have not liked it. You know, I had mentioned about a few individuals whom we departed square pegs in round holes and things like that. But that it was, you know, because the whole objective of writing the book is to make the reader learn and understand what I was going through.
Mm.
Or how I broke down in front of my own team members. And I have written it without any, shall I say, hesitation, you know.
Mm.
So openness has played a very, very important role. And, you know, ultimately, if I have an open relationship, then only I'll tell you.
Correct.
That I feel like this. But if the relationship is distance and, you know, I'm not feeling comfortable, then in case of Saugata, you may have said that, okay, I'm leaving.
Hmm.
I don't see a potential for myself. And rather than talking to my boss, I'll just leave.
Hmm.
So it's very, very important to have a high degree of openness to so that you're removing the artificial barriers of communication and also frustrations. You know, if I'm not open with you, it's better that I'll go on gossiping behind your back. I will tell 10 other people that you are like this or you like this, but I will not tell you. So we have had multiple sessions in the past where we would go out, the boss and the team members, to an outside location with an external facilitator. Just an overnight thing. Part of it is bonding. We can discuss some, but one session is on openness. What I like about you, what I don't like about you. And if there is lack of openness, that outside facilitator triggers. The objective is not to just give the feedback to the boss, but at a peer level also. You know, if I am peer with you, I should be able to tell you I don't like, including some silly habit you may have, you know.
Sure.
You may be just digging your nose. And I don't like it. Yeah.
Blind spot, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, those kind of minute things which are bugging me, you know, I should be able to take out and tell you openly. Or I am a stingy person, you know, for example. Okay, you're not spending, you know, you could be a little bit more liberal in terms of just, I'm saying those issues also which normally you tend to bitch about that person behind your back. If you can tell on that person's face, then, you know, the organization would be, hopefully, would be much less gossipy, less political. And that's what I wanted from day one, because I've never worked outside in any other company. And whenever I recruited individuals from outside, they go and say, oh, this, in this company, you have to climb a ladder and you have to, you know, there is a lot of politicking. And I would just start wondering, you know, how can I avoid all that in Marico, you know?
Yes, it's interesting, right? Yeah. It's one thing for you to have these set of values and live them, but it's another to percolate that through the organization.
Yeah.
So, any other things that you've done in Marico? Of course, it's an open, big question.
Yeah.
But any things that stand out? Any rituals?
I would say that, I mean, I would, some big steps we took, which are way, way ahead of other. Before it became so-called fashionable or before it became a corporate thrust area, we did it years and years back before others started doing it. So the whole emphasis on culture and values, which happened in the early 90s and the kind of steps we took. I just read the book by Netflix promoter, and what they are doing is we have done 30 years back, you know, in terms of no expense statements, no authorization of that, high degree of openness, you know, asking people to go if they're not doing well. We've done all that earlier, you know, no leave records.
These were based on your principles and your...
Yeah, I mean, it was not necessarily mine. It was joint, you know. It was not something which was... So, sure. I always felt that, you know, everything, I've not done it. But we created an atmosphere where people could add value, you know. So, whether it is culture building or the purpose of the organization, now in the pandemic, everybody is saying purpose is very important. You have to look at all the stakeholders. But we have looked at it for the last 20 years, you know, when we had a purpose, which is our purpose to make a difference to all the stakeholders, you know, whether it's our consumers or whether it is our associates or our own employees, you know, because all of them are interlinked. Or similarly, our portfolio choice of the products we are in. We had identified spaces where we can become market leaders, you know. So when I read the book Blue Ocean, it reinforced what we were doing for many, many years. So we were operating in spaces where we definitely saw that we had potential to grow and not go into spaces where we would be very weak players.
On that note, Harsh, the other piece that was interesting was the relationship between you and Professor Ramcharan.
Yes.
You know, while we spoke about the board, the other piece I'm curious about is how entrepreneurs like you assemble a personal board of directors, you know, a personal advisors. Yeah. How have you thought about that at different points in time?
So, I don't have a personal set of advisors with who meet collectively. I've never had it. But I've always had individuals whom I can talk to. Because they say it's lonely at the top. Many of the organizational issues you can't discuss with your own team because it concerns them. So now I use board collectively. So the need to go to individual consultants would be lesser because we have an effective board. So many of the issues which I couldn't have discussed, I can discuss with board without the management team. But I, depending on what is my need at that particular point of time, I have worked with many individuals who have helped me in my journey. So when we needed innovation, we went to Rajiv Narang or everyone. We needed HR, we went to somebody else, PM Kumar. So there are individuals who have worked at that particular phase in my own journey to help me improve on some gap I had or which I needed to do for culture building, went to Dr. Mrityunjay Jatraya. So I worked with individual consultants like that, many individual consultants. But with Ram Charan, I have had a much more, shall I say, longer relationship, because it's, I mean, I don't meet him often. He is based out of US. When he comes here, he is, I have a different set of equation with him. It's not based on any contractual kind of a relationship. It's more a personal relationship. Whenever I have needed any help, I can reach out to him and he's there for me. So when this book was written, somebody suggested, one other consultant whom I deal with, he suggested that why don't you approach Professor Ram Charan to co-author, because he is a big name. He has got, he's written 30 books, selling more than 4 million copies. But I asked him and he immediately agreed. And there's nothing for him, you know, he came specially, he must have spent 2-3 days with me on the book. He helped me structure the book. I went 2 days to US to meet him on that front. And he has not expected anything out of it. But he has almost treated me like, with a lot of love and affection, and also ready to help me whenever I wanted. And I'm meeting him next week. I'm in Delhi.
Okay.
So he is coming to Delhi for a physical training program, which is organized on corporate governance and board effectiveness.
Okay.
So I'm also speaking, and he's also going to be, he's the main speaker. I'm going to be there only for a short session.
Wonderful. Where I was going, Harsh, was along the way, what made the book interesting was two different angles on the same situation. You narrate it and then he gives his perspective.
Yes.
And I think that...
So, you're absolutely right. We wanted the book light reading in terms of a story format. So, that's what we did. My wife helped me in making that happen in terms of asking me the right questions and, you know, writing the book. And then after reading that part, he gave his insights.
Correct.
So at one level, easy reading, but at the same time, a lot of take-home value. And
correct.
I can tell you that why I've given this book. The book has been now in the market for last August, September, 2.5 months. And very good feedback from those who read it. And we have seen individuals coming from different backgrounds. Professionals, entrepreneurs, students, housewives. And each of them have come to me that there is some take-home value for me from that book, because it is written in a very lucid manner, and also insights are given depending on what's your background. One thing I'm absolutely sure that this book, I can challenge anybody, you'll have some take-home value from this book.
True. And at some level, you're bringing a lot of heart and passion and vulnerability from your end, and he brings a lot of insight.
Correct.
Synthesis.
Yes. So my job is to ensure that this book becomes a case study in management schools. So it so happened that I sent book to 3 or 4 campuses, and all of them have responded very positively. In the next half an hour, I have a discussion with INSEAD Singapore. Okay. I am going to address the class of Singapore of MBA students. Next week, I have a meeting with SP Jain, IIM Bangalore, and ISB. And they are all keen to write case studies based on book. Because if that happens, the whole objective of writing my book is to disseminate learning. I mean, financially, it's a drain on me. But the whole objective is if I can make a difference to others,
right?
I think I would be very happy.
Lovely. Congratulations on all the success.
Thank you.
I think just closing out on that, while Professor Ram Charan has a lot of things to say about you, as an advisor and given the profession I'm in, I'm curious about how people like Professor Ram Charan add value. Apart from contributing to the book, if you just took a, you know, over the years, what's the, you know, how do people like him?
You have to be clear, and I'm not now referring to Professor Ram Charan, I'm talking to any consultant. Many times entrepreneurs think that I need a consultant, but when I ask them, what do you expect for the consultant? They are not very sure what they wanted. They just want a consultant. You have to be very, very clear what is that consultant you require for, you know. And I have always been very clear, okay, I want to improve my innovation capabilities within the organization. So what do I need to do to drive innovations? More a process. And I always look at a consultant from a process point of view. How do I improve process of board management? And what I talked earlier about effective board management, I learned it from Ram Charan. Because he did a retreat with us and the board members. He met each of them individually. And then we met collectively in terms of how do you get the best out of the board members? How do you give feedback? How do you craft agenda? So I've used him extensively for improving our processes of innovation, effective board management. He's been some sort of a coach to me at an individual level when I need some inputs. So it's more to do with the process and coaching.
You remind me of one thing I learned from one of my professors who taught marketing in IIM Ahmedabad, Professor A.K. Jain, Abhinandan Jain. I don't know if you met him. He would say, if you can define the problem sharply, the answer very often will follow.
True.
If you don't spend enough time on the problem, he will always say, have you framed the problem? So, back to the transition with Saugata, Harsh, once again, from your lens, could you talk a little bit about you stepping away from an MD role to the chairman role? Once again, I find that, you know, in transitions, if we look at a start, stop, continue list, people start things easily, but people find it difficult to stop what they were doing earlier.
Yes.
So from your perspective, how did you, what are some of the lessons you've learned in stepping back?
So when I decided to step back, the first thing my board asked me to do was that please write down what you will do as chairman, and the MD should write down what he should do.
Independently.
So we did that. I wrote down my thoughts, he wrote down his thoughts, and we dialogued based on those notes, and we came with a very crystal clear proposition of what is my role, where will I get involved, what decisions will come to me, what decisions will not come to me. So that high degree of clarity has played a very, very important role in our effective relationships, which has gone off very smoothly for 5-6 years. That role can change over a period of time. It's not cast in stone. But at that particular point of time, you should be clear. When will you get involved? And just to give you one or two examples, earlier I used to do a lot of investor meets with our investors. And once I stepped down, I said, I don't need to do that. It's managing director's role in terms of investor conferences. So I have withdrawn myself completely from that role. Except in some cases, some old investor whom I have had built a relationship once in a while, if they want me to meet them, it's more as an exception. Similarly, in the area of media, he is going to manage the business. I will be involved. But it is important that he talks to the media and I don't talk to the media about the company. Because if both of us start talking, then we may be giving conflicting signals. So it's clear that my interaction with media will be mainly on macro issues or something else which I'm doing like Ascent or Marico Innovation Foundation. But company issues he will only handle. I will not get into it. So clarity to that extent, nth extent, has really helped us exist. It's very clear that I will have a meeting, review meeting with him and his team every month. I will have skip level meetings with his team. I will be involved before he finalizes any individual who is going to report to him. So some people decisions I will be involved, but nothing will come to me on a day-to-day basis. Who's our advertising agency? Who's our banker? I don't even know many times, you know.
The other piece I find interesting, Harsh, is let's say from 100% involvement, you slowly move down to 20. Of course, it's not a step jump. It's a gradual jump. But a lot of entrepreneurs struggle to fill the remaining 80%.
You're absolutely right. That was my biggest. That was because I am the kind of person who cannot just idle along. You know,
give us a sense of how you filled up the rest.
Of course, I play golf and I love playing golf on weekends. But I can't play golf every day. I have to be mentally occupied. And one of my wife was really worried. I said, what will you do? I mean, you'll sit at home and you'll eat up my head and whatnot. But it so happened that the way things have turned out and my interests of doing things, I am fully occupied in terms of various things I am doing, including giving. I started doing much more on terms of giving side from my personal end as well as from the company and on board of my own companies as well as external board, advisory board of some private equity companies. My son started a business involved in that. I started a new business from my personal end. So it's and then I started writing the book.
But
I have
a lot
of talking, speaking assignments. So I'm.
But is there a theme? Is there a theme to how you, did you want to do a certain kinds of things? Let's say the rest of the portfolio. Did it evolve slowly, or were you clear that you will do a certain set of things?
No, you have to be passionate about what you're doing. You have to like what you're doing. So it evolved. But it was centering on my likes and my preferences.
The other theme I was curious about was your children, Rishabh and Raj.
Yeah.
Right? How have you thought about, A, you know, as they grew up, clearly you'd experience success. So one aspect I'm curious about is, as parents, you know, very often we are in situations where the economic context we experience and what the child experiences are quite different. So how have you thought about bringing them up with a certain sense of grounding? And how have you thought about their role in the family business versus doing stuff?
So a lot of my thinking has been based on my own journey, you know. So my father let me alone and he never guided me. I decided to get into consumer products on my own. So I strongly believe that each person is born with a certain God-given gifts. And you have some passion of doing something. And just because you are my child doesn't mean that you have to do what I was doing. Unfortunately, in Indian society, that's expected that your son will inherit you. In my case, both my children are very independent and they want to craft their own journey. So it was very clear that they would want to do something, and both of them have been successfully doing that in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
So my son has started a investment office, which he is very passionate about and which he has initial for 4 or 5 years been extremely successful. So he can now say that this is my doing and not that I inherited my father's
his identity
journey. He has created it. Similarly, my daughter is doing two things. She's one of the top most canine behaviorists in definitely in Bombay.
Wow.
Where she has dogs and cats, canine and feline, and birds and all that. So she's very passionate about
it. Very niche specialization.
Yeah. And her viewpoint is that it's the problem is with the owners and not with the, with the animals, you know. So she goes and teaches, she goes to their houses, and any problematic pet, she can handle it, you know.
Wow.
And then she is also very passionate about the mental health part, which I'm supporting.
Hmm.
So we are one of the leading mental health grant agency in India.
Hmm.
And she runs that. So both of them are gainfully employed. My son is also on board of Merico because I needed somebody, God forbid something happened to me too.
As a custodian.
As a custodian. So he's not the chairman, I'm the chairman, but over a period of time I'm grooming him to be the chairman of the company.
Hmm. Hmm. I think, you know, you've been through a lot of experiences, Harsh, building Merico, you know, post giving up the active role. You've got your two children who are successful in their own path. This podcast is titled Play to Potential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we wrap up, I'm curious about what this phrase means to different people.
Yeah.
What does this phrase mean to you?
So, to me, it means that how do you identify your strengths? Many a times, we don't know our own strengths. And I think the starting point is identifying our own strengths. And that can happen through interactions with those who are close to us. It could be family, it could be very close friends. And very simple way of doing it is, okay, just let's meet one day and tell me about what you think about me. What are my strengths? What are my areas requiring improvement? And it could be a 1 or 2 hour discussion, just open-ended, brainstorm. It'll give me an overall picture of what others think of me. And I need not agree with what they're saying.
Sure.
But if I have blind spots in terms of my own strengths or areas requiring improvement, I will be aware of that. Having done that, I have a 75-25 rule that 75% of your time should go into leveraging your strengths. If I am weak in technology, I can't enter a business which requires technological input. It's better that I don't get into that business. But if I am very good in consumer insighting, and then you go into fast-moving consumer goods. It is something which I like doing it. It's my strength. Normally, because it is my strength, it is my passion. And I enjoy doing it rather than doing something which I don't like doing it, where I may not succeed. So I think most of us tend to say that, okay, I have a lot of weakness. Let me go on improving. And don't take as many steps to leverage our strengths. So I'm saying that we have to go on fine-tuning our strengths, which is far more enjoyable journey.
Hmm.
If you have some fatal flaws, which you need to improve upon in your own journey, then of course that you have to take it very seriously. But small flaws, which is part of every individual, you know, each person has flaws. I'm not saying don't do anything about it, but have that 75-25% rule.
And did you say you go on seeking feedback, not just from people at work, but from family and other people?
Anybody, like I mean, Ramcharan said to me, but you have this inherent quality of you go on digging deep and you go on trying their curiosity and all. I never thought that was my strength, you know.
Hmm.
But, you know, sometimes you don't realize what is your strength.
Hmm.
So it could be from anybody whom you're interacting with.
Hmm.
But you have to be open, you have to go on asking.
Correct.
Others, you know, yeah.
Correct. Lovely, Harsh. Pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of messages before we wrap up. If you're interested in receiving short 2-minute extracts of wisdom from the podcast, served up once or twice a week, do consider signing up by sending a WhatsApp message at +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Here, we share short extracts across the various guests we have at the podcast. Do also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a big difference in people discovering this podcast amidst a lot of noise that's out there given the boom in the podcast supply in India in the last few months. It also helps us attract good quality speakers who look at these kinds of metrics. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. Thank you, and hope to have you tune into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.